From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Military veteran turned anti-war activist S. Brian Wilson has written and published a new book, Blood on the Tracks, which details his life story and the dramatic protest at the Grand Naval Station in Concord back in September of 1987. That culminated in his losing both his legs over the shipping of arms to the Contras in Central America. He'll join us in studio for the hour, which will include your calls, emails, and your online questions and comments. That's on Forum, next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. And if you heard the end of the last hour and got excited when you heard Brian Wilson, actually I said S. Brian Wilson, and Wilson with two L's, you may have thought the bearded giant was going to be in here from pitching performance par excellence or from the Beach Boys. But we actually have another Brian Wilson who made headlines back on the 1st of September 1987. He was part of a nonviolent protest blocking a munitions train at the Concord Naval Weapons Station here in the Bay Area. The protesters were there to block the train from delivering bombs headed for Central America and the war that was raging between the U.S.-backed Contra Army and the Nicaraguan Sandinistas. The locomotive did not stop and ran over protester Brian Wilson, who had been a commander, intelligence and combat officer, and Air Force captain in the Vietnam War. Brian Wilson lost both of his legs, which are now prosthetic, and endured a torn-up arm as well as a fractured skull, which caused his brain to be exposed and many other damages to him. And this episode in his life is fully recounted in his newest book. It's actually his third book, with an introduction by Daniel Ellsberg, the former military analyst who released the Pentagon Papers. The book is called Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson, and it takes us through Wilson's life from a small-town rural American upbringing in central New York State as a communist-hating, military-loving, star baseball-playing Baptist to his present life as an anti-war and environmental activist. He's presently on what he calls a carbon-free book tour, riding through over 1,000 western state miles on a low-slung tricycle powered by handbrakes. And he joins us in studio for this morning's second forum hour. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you know, the focus in your life, to put it mildly, was on that moment or those moments back in September 1987. You went back 24 years later and actually you were asked if you were a terrorist. Is that right?
Yeah, I was on my way to a book talk in Walnut Creek at the Mount Diablo Peace Center, and we just decided to just stop at the station for a moment to look at the spot on the tracks where I was hit. And we were there 2 minutes when we were when six police cars came from three directions and swooped down and rushed out of their cars and surrounded us. And it's like I was actually just standing there. I wasn't even on the property of the base. I was just standing on the shoulder of the road. And it was a startling welcoming. And it was a combination of Contra Costa County sheriff's deputies and these new Army security police. They weren't MPs. They had black uniforms. I tried to read they had something on their uniforms. And they wanted to know who we were, why we were there. They wanted all our IDs. And they said, we have to find out whether you are part of any terrorist organization, which seemed so
ironic.
Since I was called a terrorist 24 years earlier. Well, when they continued to question me, they said, why would you be here at this moment? I said, well, I'm just on my way to a book talk in Walnut Creek, and I thought I would stop. Oh, you have a book? You really have a book? I said, yes. They wanted to know the title of it. I said, Blood on the Tracks. I said, my blood on those tracks. I said, oh, you're the guy?
And the he recognized him.
Yeah, not the two guys that were interrogating me initially, but then they went to their boss, who was, I think he was a sheriff's deputy, or at least he seemed to be the honcho at that moment with the six vehicles. He said, oh, we read that you were going to be in the area, and it's interesting that you came here. And he said, when I was 9 years old, when you got hit, and you're a legend, and I want to shake your hand.
So it had a nice ending.
It had a nice ending.
Yeah. But what was it like going back after all those years for you?
Well, I've been back before. I mean, I was back there for the 20th anniversary in 2007. And I've been there at other times over the years. But it's there's a certain amount of emotional content when I'm going there and looking at that scene. And
of course, the tracks have been ripped up, weren't they?
Four days after I was hit, 9,000 people showed up to the tracks and ripped up 300 feet of the tracks and stacked up the railroad ties and sculptures, and the police were outnumbered. They just had to watch it. Their tracks were repaired within a week or two, but by that time there was a permanent encampment of people on the tracks, and that permanent encampment was there for 28 straight months, day and night, and so no train was able to move without multiple arrests, much to the shock of the authorities. And so,
well, it speaks to the efficacy of the demonstration and the activism.
2,000 people were arrested. Several people had their arms broken in the arresting process. I mean, it was pretty rough out there.
But it was also because what happened to you was so dramatic.
Yes, of course, it was dramatic, and it was bizarre and criminal, and you know, it was terrible.
Anybody held accountable for criminal acts?
No,
never.
We tried to get the district attorney in Contra Costa County, we tried to get the state attorney general, and we tried to get the U.S. attorney general to bring criminal charges against the train crew and their superiors. They refused. They charged me with trespassing, and then I sued the Navy, and we were in pretrial preparations for over 3 years and finally settled. But in fact, the Navy report of the assault was a very good report, actually. It was quite honest, but it was never released by the Secretary of Navy. So I have a copy of it.
So it remained confidential?
Well, I have a copy of it.
I was going to say.
But it was never days, it never was released.
The day of WikiLeaks, you can get copies of all kinds of things.
But it was, and the report recommended, I think, dismissal of the train crew who were civilian employees of the Navy. They were Vietnam veterans. But civilian employees at the time of the Navy. And I think they recommended that the commander, Cagle, be suspended for 4 months or something. But that was none of those recommendations were implemented.
Well, you were a commander, as I said, earlier in Vietnam. Vietnam was an awakening for you.
Yeah, definitely was.
I mean, it really led sort of the trajectory to what happened in Concord.
Correct. I was a trained installation security officer. I was a trained Air Force Ranger at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Even though it was an Army base, they trained Air Force people there. And I was in Vietnam in 69 in charge of security. I was a commander of the night security of Binh Tui Air Base and then later at Phan Rang base. And so, you know, I had plenty of military experience. But I actually had an awakening. I was 27 when I was in Vietnam, a little older than the average soldier that wasn't a lifer. I was drafted at 25, actually, which was a little unusual. And I witnessed the after effects of bombings of villages. And so in 1 week, I witnessed somewhere between 700 and 900 murdered Vietnamese. They were all villagers and fishing villages, and I was in shock. I couldn't fathom it. I threw up. I was...
You saw children affected with napalm and all
Yes, and blackened bodies. And I had never experienced anything like this, and I couldn't believe it. And I became very anti-war at that point. And I was a first lieutenant then, but I expressed my outrage at the war to my superiors every day after that. And but I was a fairly... had a significant job of... my men had all the machine guns and the starlight scopes and the anti-personnel radar and the outgoing mortars. And so my adrenaline was working, for sure, so I could perform the functions. But I was, during the daytime, I was just saying, this is criminal. It violates Nuremberg. It violates my rules of engagement. I had to learn as an officer, you do not target civilians and you do not target civilian infrastructure. They said... just get out of here. I mean, just get out of the command bunker when I would be saying that. It was, you know, just There were no war, rules of war.
Well, you mentioned Nuremberg, and in fact, there was a Nuremberg fast, 40-day fasting on water, which got a great deal of attention that you and others were involved in, other veterans of the Vietnam War. And I wonder, from this perspective of time, when you think about the kind of demonstrations that you were involved in, I mean, fasting, for example. I remember Leroy Jones saying fasting is against the individual. It doesn't, you know, it's not a good form of the self-immolations. In fact, you write about Norman Morrison, who set himself on fire, and all the Buddhist monks during the Vietnam War, and going out and protesting a conquered, laying oneself down on the tracks.
Or sitting on the tracks.
Or sitting on the tracks, right, and expecting it to be a nonviolent arrest and so forth, and getting run over. But when you look back on it, what are really the more effective means of protest, do you think?
Well, I'm still asking that question to this day. To me, I've needed, obviously, to find a way to express the depth of my feelings in relationship to the policies that are causing the suffering. And I have gone through the petitioning process and lobbying process. I was a lobbyist in the 70s, actually, when I worked for the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. And in the 80s, like a lot of people, were petitioning Congress to stop the illegal wars in Central America. And they continue. And so at some point, of course, going to Concord was where the weapons were coming from for Salvador and Nicaragua. And so that was actually going to the place where the weapons were moving from the United States to Central America. And so blocking the trains was not just symbolic. It was a little bit more than that. It was kind of trying to obstruct and use that as a teaching method to say, this is why we're doing this, and maybe you can resonate with the reasoning of it. Fasting to me was, we fasted in 1986, four of us on the steps of the Capitol for 47 days on water only, and it was really just a public expression of the depth of our anguish and sharing that with the public as best we could. It's not like we have any formula for how to move people or how to change policies, but some of us are not able to just sit around.
Well, you haven't sat around. You read your book, you realize you've been to Panama, to Palestine, to Iraq, Mexico, Haiti, I mean, to so many places. But it must sometimes be a little anguishing now to think there are three wars going on, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya, and where is the protest? Where is the momentum?
Well, it's pathetic. In my book, it's the peace movement is pathetic at this point. I don't know. I think we're going through some very deeply historical psychic shift with perhaps after Obama's election, people maybe recognize now more than ever the almost totally corrupt nature of our political economic process, and perhaps that requires a few years or maybe a decade, I don't know, to reflect what that really means, and it may mean quite a dramatic change in the way people express their outrage. It might mean massive obstructions of business as usual, like we see in Tunisia and Egypt. We're nowhere near there at this point, as far as I can tell. But there's a lot of misery in this country, and it's going to get worse. And I don't know whether people will actually become disobedient in a collective, constructive way, or whether they will. You know, we're pretty spoiled here. So I don't have a clue, actually, how to address this issue. But when I said in Portland to my Transition Town Initiative people who were talking about energy descent, the need to reduce our consumption of energy, that I was cycling to San Francisco with my book, and they laughed. And I said, but I've said I may not get there, but my intention is to begin cycling south, and I'm going to go from town to town. And
this is with handbrakes.
Well, it's a hand pedals.
I mean, hand powered. Excuse me.
Hand powered, and it's one crank at a time. I figure
each is a revolution. You say, right?
Yeah. Each rotation of my wheel gets me 6 feet, and that's one revolution. And 700,000 revolutions later, I got to San Francisco, which equals for me a new policy of moving my weight and myself from one point to another without burning fossil fuels. It's like, okay, it's possible, you know.
Talking to Brian Wilson. S. Brian Wilson is the author of Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson, with an introduction to his book by Daniel Ellsberg. You seem pessimistic about the anti-war movement or the peace movement, but what about the environmental movement? You know, I'm often asked by people, what do I see of young people today? And I see much more concern about the planet and about sustainability. And you've built a solar-powered home up in Portland, and you talked about Neolithic villages and living small and all that, radical downsizing for sustainability. These are things that you've come to stand for now in your life. Are you more optimistic about those?
Well, I think it's inevitable. I think our survival requires this radical downsizing of our consumption levels and more cooperation horizontally rather than thinking of vertical structures, which are our political, economic systems, which we've been born and raised in. I think that we're going through an incredible historical shift, and we're going to be corrected one way or the other.
We meaning the American way of life?
I mean the whole Western consumption model, which is now adopted by India and China and so forth. We as a species who want to do this, continue this incredible carbon consumption, basically, we will be corrected because it's a totally unsustainable way of living, and the Earth will basically create a new correction system, which will humble us to some kind of simplicity. And I'm just interested in participating in the process of simplifying our lives and knowing how exciting it really is to begin taking responsibility with your neighbors for living more locally. It actually is quite it's quite satisfying when you actually do it.
You even have a name for it, radical relational rationality.
Yeah.
Mutuality, excuse me.
Right. It's just everything's connected to everything at every moment. And in that process, you realize that kind of the universe or the life force of the universe, you're cooperating with something far bigger than yourself that is already here, and you're getting your ideological training kind of a little bit out of the way so that you actually can begin cooperating and rather than trying to outcompete everybody. It's a shift. It's a radical shift in the way we think.
Have you shifted from being more anti-war activist to being more environmental activist?
Well, I think of it as just modeling a new way of life. The environmental activists in a way have tended, at least many of them, to allow the system to remain intact without questioning our way of life. They want to preserve wilderness and stop certain things from happening, which are very good goals. But the fact is we need to remove mountaintops of coal and to do fracking for natural gas and tar sands removal and deep water drilling if we want to continue our way of life, because our lifestyle demands the energy. So we have to understand the connection between our demand for continuing our way of life and all the new extraction methods that are getting more desperate to find the energy.
Unless we have the political will to find alternative forms of energy, which you have done with your home.
But the will, for the will to be expressed in a oligarchic, the cabal that runs the society now, we have to obstruct their capacity to function.
Who are those oligarchs? Who is that cabal? Who do you
see? Well, it'd be the military-industrial complex, the weapons makers, Congress, the president.
All part of that machinery?
They're all part of it because they make a lot of money on wars. And they own the system. They basically own the political structure. And if we continue to vote and pay taxes, we're legitimizing it. I mean, it's quite a moment to be severely questioning. I'm still severely questioning myself, what I'm doing, what I'm going to do, because I've been all conditioned just like everybody else. And it's a process of extricating oneself from this deep dependency on centralized systems that have been basically benefited from a century of the blip of oil, and that century that took half the carbon out of the ground that formed 300 million years and in one century put half of it in the air, water, and soil, that's a blip in history. And it ain't going to be around a whole lot longer.
Again, our guest is Brian Wilson, author of Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson. And let me open the phone lines. I know there are many of you, of course, who remember what occurred on the 1st of September 1987 when that Well, tragedy occurred, but Brian is still here to talk about it and still has his, obviously, political commitment and vitality. If you'd like to join us, if you have memories of that time, or if you'd like to simply ask him a question or talk with him, our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, toll-free to join us now at 866-733-6786. Or send an email to forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. Do you have any regrets? I mean, deep regrets about what you set out to do and what was accomplished or what resulted and the consequences of it?
Well, I have no regrets of being at the tracks and sitting on the tracks. I mean, I had told the commander of the base exactly what we were doing, why we were doing it, where and when we were doing it. It was going to be a 40-day fast. Asked for a meeting, personal meeting with him, and he refused. But he had my letter in writing, and it was just a step up of my own expression of nonviolent resistance, but I also know that every time you're honestly expressing yourself, it is an educational moment beyond yourself. And so I have no regrets. I'm sorry I lost my legs, but I have had a wonderful prosthetist, and I walk fairly well, and I learned how to hand cycle. And so I've done 55,000 miles on my hand cycle in about 14 years, so it's opened up a whole other way of moving myself around.
What about Nicaragua? If we could talk about that just for a moment, because you were there and there were thousands of people who greeted you, and Daniel Ortega, who has gone into maybe another view where the public is concerned. I mean, had a problem with his pedophilia and all kinds of dreadful sorts of things that at least were alleged and, in fact, proven to be the case. And the Sandinistas have sort of fallen off the radar screen for many people.
Well, you know, they went through a terrible Reagan war against them, killed at least 35,000 and maimed thousands of others. When the Sandinistas lost the elections in 1990, they actually relinquished power through the legal process. They didn't do any another. They didn't resort to arms to retain their power. And it's really tough living in these countries where they've been so savaged and ravaged by, especially the United States, over the decades. And now they're desperate for cash. Their economies were devastated in the war. And now Ortega's back in the presidency, having made a compromise with the former right-wing president. And he, you know, I'm disappointed that he's not the revolutionary he once was, but if he was the revolutionary he once was, he probably wouldn't be the president. And I can't totally judge people for trying to figure out how to survive when I'm not living in their.
But what about the pedophilia?
That was, you know, of his own stepdaughter. And of course he denied it and never really wanted to talk about it. It was a terrible, terrible indictment on his character. His wife, Rosario Murillo, who's the mother of the child from a previous marriage,
right.
She absolutely defended Danielle and condemned her own daughter.
We're going to continue with our guest, Brian Wilson, his book, Blood on the Tracks. When we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with activist for Veterans Peace Action Team and author of Blood on the Tracks, S. Brian Wilson, a military veteran who turned anti-war activist and who has written this new book, Blood on the Tracks, which details, among other things, how he lost his legs protesting arms shipments to Central America. And as I said earlier, he's been involved as an activist not only in with respect to Central America, Nicaragua and El Salvador, but also Panama. Some of you remember the war in Panama, the war in Iraq also has been involved in a very significant way with respect to Mexico and Haiti, and been a lot of places and has certainly been involved in a lot of activist activity and is here with us to talk about his book. And we were talking a little bit off air about early influences in his life. Reading his book was nothing less than a revelation about, you know, a young country boy kind of coming across when he was at a Baptist college, a book that awakened many of us, Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. I mean, when you think about it, you were thinking about what kind of effect could this had on my little town, the town you grew up in, playing in nature and being a kid close to nature. And now it comes full circle. Here you are, an environmental activist. I mean, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Yeah, I want to preserve this beautiful, you know, nature that we have, which is part of us.
And this planet, just for a moment before I go to our callers and find out what's on their mind with questions or comments, you had a couple of really – you had a lot of mentors. You mentioned David Dellinger, a name that many remember, but also Wally and Juanita Nelson particularly, who were radical homesteaders, who were, well, tax refuseniks, I guess you could call them, and who did time as a result. And he was a freedom rider. These were people who had a major transformative effect.
Yes, they were such simple people with – I mean, simple, they live simply, but had incredible courage to live outside the quote-unquote American way of life, and it would express their resistance their lives were, in a sense, a model of how to live simply and not cooperate with the nation state, which they thought was just ripping apart humanity and the planet. And that really, I mean, I was inspired to tears meeting with people like that. And in fact, for a while, I lived next to Wally and Juanita Nelson's homestead in Deerfield, Massachusetts.
Forgive me, but aren't people sometimes inspired by tears meeting you?
Yes, perhaps. But I'm just sharing my inspiration with others, and then if that inspires them, fine. It's good. It's we're all wired socially. We've been living as if we're not wired socially, but we really are genetically wired to be social beings cooperating with one another. And it's quite exciting when you start actually doing it.
Omnicentric is the word you use, which is a good word. Actually, here's a listener, Roberto, who says, his work to connect peace work with environmental justice is exciting and refreshing, and I wonder where he would be willing to make great sacrifice again if he were 20 years younger.
Oh, I'd probably be at the mountaintop removal resistance in West Virginia, because I spent lots of camping trips in West Virginia when I lived in Washington, D.C. I don't know.
Have you seen The Last Mountain? We had Robert Kennedy Jr. on talking about that.
The film?
Yeah.
I've seen two films on West Virginia coal removal, and I don't know if that was the name of one of them or not. Yeah, I think it was, because Robert Kennedy was involved with one of them. But I don't know. I actually also want to live simply so that I'm not contributing to the demand for the energy that requires extracting in very environmentally harmful ways. And so I think I'm trying to integrate being an obstruction to the continuation of the destruction of the planet, and at the same time simplify my life so that I'm creating less demand for these resources. And it's really tricky because I, like most people, have been very conditioned into a consumptive way of life, which is simply not sustainable. I'm struggling with it myself.
Let's go to our callers, and we'll begin with you, Bradford. You're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thank you. I was born and raised a Quaker in Philadelphia, so I was saddened to hear that Mr. Wilson says that the peace movement is pathetic, and I would have to agree, sadly. I'm wondering if he would think that a lot of us have been beaten down over the years by being told that if you're not for the troops, then you're not a patriot and you're against the country. And how do we get our voices heard? And I'll take my answer off the air. And thank you for your good work and your wonderful writings.
Thank you for the call. You're still struggling with these questions.
I'm struggling with these questions. I mean, I think that the best thing would be to get 50, 100,000 people to go and obstruct business as usual in Washington, which means just sitting someplace indefinitely, doing nothing but sitting, and perhaps next to a street or possibly in a street, but just even on the mall.
People are too busy with their iPods for
right,
that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And they got to get away from their iPods. And they've got to realize that we're in a serious predicament, and all humanity is connected. And we've been very disconnected from humanity for a long time in the West. And so I'm struggling with it. I think people, it would be good if people simplified their lives and lived below the taxable level, or even if they didn't do that, to become tax refusers and begin getting rid of their property. So they actually, which I did myself with the IRS over the years.
Have you refused to pay taxes?
I refused.
But you didn't get prosecuted?
No, but I thought I would be prosecuted.
Because there's so many in jail who have
16
said...
16 years. You know. But I had to get rid of my property and my bank accounts and paid all my bills with postal money orders. But I had to resolve going to jail. I mean, I had to resolve that that was a likely consequence. But I felt free when I made it. It took me 3 years to get clarity on that back in the early 80s. But when I got clear about it, I had 12 meetings with the IRS over the years, and I was always very clear with them that their option was to take me to prison because they didn't have anything to seize except they could seize me. And I thought my lawyer said pretty sure they were going to do that, but they didn't.
Let me go to more calls, and we'll welcome Brian. Brian, you're on.
Hello, Mr. Wilson. I'm also an ex-officer. I served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I agree with 99% of what you're saying, and I also live very simply as well. I take umbrage with the fact that you mentioned we perhaps need some kind of event in this country like Tunisia and Syria and Egypt. I wouldn't say that, and it's because there's a great loss of life that has stemmed from those events, and you know, you're talking about the 900 people murdered in Vietnam and Central America, and we would have the same kind of loss of life here, undoubtedly. And so I see a little bit of hypocrisy in that, and I'll take my answer off the air as well.
Thanks. All right. Thank you for the call.
I believe that we have to be prepared to risk our lives, limb, and prison to without retaliating. Actually, I guess you'd call me a militant pacifist. But
it sounds a little oxymoronic.
Yes, it does. But I believe being somewhat fierce about nonviolence, meaning you don't retaliate, you just are tenacious about it. And I do think that we in this country need to risk life, limb, and prison in upgrading our obstruction, a willingness to obstruct business as usual, which is absolutely business as usual is killing the planet. It's actually killing us. And so I don't want more bloodshed, but I know the amount of bloodshed we inflict all over the world is very much a result of our way of life that demands all this energy extraction, and people are in the way of it. I mean, cell phones alone are causing all this rush on precious metals in the Congo for the last 15 years. Computers, cell phones, coal, all these, I don't even know how to pronounce all these precious metals, coltan and... I have reports that 10 million Congolese have been murdered because they happen to live in the areas where the mining is going on, and their cultures are in the way of extraction. So the blood is everywhere, and I just think it's time for us to risk our own lives in solidarity with all the people who are losing their lives in order to stop what we're doing. I don't have any magic answers.
Wonder what your thoughts are about when we had Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on, talked about, again, the blowing up of mountaintops, and I admire very much the work he's doing. But I did say to him, people on the right have criticized him because he goes around in charter planes and uses up a lot more, makes a bigger carbon imprint, you know, than is necessary, or so the argument goes. It's pretty significant when you're flying around, and I know you will not go on an airplane.
Right.
And he said, in effect, you know, this is a bigger question. It has very little to do with me as an individual. But what about individual actions like that?
Well, I think it would be more powerful if he were to cycle. It's a whole nother. I mean, it seems unrealistic, but I thought this about Richard Heinberg too, who wrote this great book called The Party's Over, and he also wrote a book called Peak Everything, and it actually his analysis, I think, is wonderful. And I did mention to him that perhaps his flying around the world to share these ideas was something perhaps worthy of consideration to do an alternative, like find a sailing ship or do something dramatically different in moving yourself to these places, which, of course, slows you down. I do think...
You do what, about 10 miles an hour now?
I do average about 10 miles an hour. And actually, it's a very radically different psychological experience, moving yourself at 10 miles an hour with no wall around you, from riding in a car, or certainly flying, where there's no emphasis on the journey, it's just the destination. Well, when you're cycling, and one of the themes of my book is that life is a journey, not a destination. So cycling to me is a way of demonstrating and feeling the journey. I mean, I have to look in my mirror every second. When I'm on 101 coming down with all those log trucks up in Northern California, I'm looking at nature around me, I'm looking at the flowers, I'm looking at the wildlife. It's a very...
You're taking in a lot more.
It's thrilling. Actually, yeah. I find it kind of thrilling to be that responsible for my journey.
Again, we're talking to S. Brian Wilson. Blood on the Tracks is his book. And if you'd like to join us, you can do so by toll-free number 866-733-6786 or by email forum@kqed.org. Or if you have something you'd like to bring into the conversation or a question, you can also post some on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And we'll go to Neil as our next caller. Neil, you're on.
Yeah, I have two questions, and they may both be related. The first is this. Is it just American wars you're upset about? Would you be prepared to protest, say, genocide in Bosnia or Rwanda or wherever? And the second question is, have you been following events in Indochina since the war ended, the expulsion of the ethnic Chinese, the Boat people, the massacres in Cambodia? Are you prepared to protest those two, or do you have any opinion or analysis of those?
I, of course, don't support genocides anywheres or persecution anywheres, but my basic experiential and knowledge base always is based on, is pretty much related to my understanding of my culture and the effects my culture has on the rest of the world. So I don't know that I'd be willing to go to Bosnia to risk my life to save a genocide, but I am willing to risk my life here in this country to try to bring some sense to our policies. Remember, we're 4.6% of the world's population, and we consume anywhere between a quarter and a third of the world's resources. The only way that can happen is through theft and forced theft from other people. And I think we really have to come to terms with the fact that our lifestyle is very destructive to the planet. In effect, it's destructive to us, as we can see. We're creating so much carbon in the atmosphere that we may be creating something worse than nuclear winter. This is stupid. This goes against our. If we really want to survive as social beings on the planet, then we really need to look at what we're doing. So I have not followed all the details of Southeast Asia since I was there. My wife has got a project in Hanoi. She does fly. You know, she knows my issues about flying, but she flies and she's actually working on.
It'd be tough to cycle to Hanoi.
Yeah. Well, I told her I would sail to Asia, and we actually have discussed it a little bit, whether there's a sailboat big enough that I would be willing to have go on without getting seasick the whole time.
A lot of Dramamine.
Yeah. But she's working on a project dealing with the third and fourth generation of the effects of Agent Orange on the mutagenic effects on these offspring. And there's a whole group of a whole clinic there that she's supporting. And it's not that there's the Vietnamese themselves are being compromised by moving more towards Western development. And it's a phenomenon. It's the globalization of money.
Well, that brings up another question, and perhaps you can, with all of your global experiences, address this in some way. The Vietnamese have been very forgiving, in part, one might argue, because of their desire to advance economically. I mean, American tourists go there. There's not the desire, it seems, for retaliating against the United States. And the same is true of Central America.
Mm-hmm.
And yet in Yemen and Saudi Arabia, we have more enemies than we have in all of those other countries combined, or so it would seem, wanting to do more harm to the United States. Some speculate this may be because of all of the oil profits that the United States has made. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Well, certainly the Vietnamese are very forgiving, and I have a lot of veteran friends who've gone over there, and they're just amazed at how they're welcomed and hugged by the Vietnamese. Of course, the vets are going there as their own reconciliation, own atonement process.
And many of them are involved in building and rebuilding.
And rebuilding clinics, and it's really very therapeutic. In terms of the Middle East, you know, I think one of the issues that's very disturbing to all of us, and or to many of us, and certainly to everybody, almost everybody in the Middle East, is the whole Palestinian-Israeli question. I think it just drives a toxic psychic spike into everybody, the double standard that the West is applying towards Palestine and Israel. And, of course, we've made deals with those countries since World War II for the oil. And only, ironically, only Iran and Iraq and Libya, I think, in that region have actually distributed the oil money so that they have education and health care for everybody. And, of course, Libya is not going to be doing that anymore. And Iraq was destroyed in 1991. And we certainly are talking about destroying Iran. These are countries that actually did not cry uncle like the other Arab countries. And so I think it's very complicated psychologically how people are affected with rage based on the behavior of, in my analysis, the behavior of my country. And our country's policies are driven by extraction and exploitation in order to maintain a Western way of life. I think we just have to face that. We have to face the fact that we're living off other people's pain, and that is not a good thing to be doing.
Let me bring more of our callers in. Scott, join us. You're on the air.
Morning. Just joined you maybe 10 minutes ago, but I just wanted to share that your comments and your perspective really resonate with me. And I also wanted to share that I don't hear a lot of this on the mainstream media, but I do hear a lot of what you're talking about and similar themes on a lot of social network media with, no offense to you or anyone, with a younger generation. And I sense that this younger generation does not automatically snap to the, plunder model. It's more of a sharing, a collaborative model. And I really feel like the frequency of people talking about the things that you're talking about, it's picking up steam. And I don't know exactly how it's going to manifest, but I think that we're going to head in the right direction. But I think, like with all of our systems that are broken right now, education, our political system, our financial system, there's so many of them, our infrastructure, our energy source, that this younger generation is going to grow up and they're going to look around and say, oh, my God, what have you done to our society? And I think they're going to actually reboot it or reset it. But I think the scary thing is we don't know what form that's going to take. So, but anyways, I just wanted to really thank you for your efforts and all your work that you do.
Thank you, Scott. Well, you talk about Americans being AWOL.
Absent without leave. Yeah, American way of life. My working title of my manuscript was Going AWOL from the American Way of Life. I actually do think that a lot of the young people I meet in Portland, Oregon, where I live, they clearly know that this whole system is so corrupt. They can't take it seriously at all. Now, I don't know whether they can get away from their iPods long enough, but I mean, actually, a lot of them are. I've been impressed with they would call themselves anarchists, and I call myself a nonviolent anarchist.
Didn't you name your dog after Kropotkin?
Yeah, Peter Kropotkin. Yeah. One of my I have a Welsh Corgi. And we named him Peter Kropotkin after Pedro. I Spanishized the first name, but Kropotkin, who wrote Mutual Aid, was one of the most significant books I read after I was out of Vietnam.
Because people hear anarchists, they get scared. You know, they think the
yeah, but anarchist is a very responsible way of taking responsibility horizontally with other people. And anarchy means without authority from above. It means we now have to take responsibility. And most anarchists are not into violence. I know that's the reputation, but it's a very serious, disciplined approach to being responsible at horizontal levels, not vertical levels. And so, but anyway, I do think a lot of the young people actually really see through it all. And the question is how it will manifest in their expression socially and collectively. And I'm also very disappointed that a lot of young people who are not particularly aware of this, their whole lives are revolved around handheld electronic devices with an attention span of about 5 seconds. And I don't think that's developing character or capacity to critique the system. But I do know there are a number of young people who really are quite astute, and that does give me encouragement.
How do you feel about drones being sent into Pakistan to essentially hit terrorist encampments, in terms of your pacifism? Would you protest that?
Yeah, of course. Some of the drones are being made in Hood River, Oregon, not too far from Portland, and I think it's hideous. I think it's taking warfare to the next step of no responsibility, of not even having any connection with the victims, and of course bombing another country. I mean, we've bombed 28 countries. The United States has bombed 28 countries since World War II. I wonder what we'd feel like if people were bombing us. I mean, you know, it's an incredible.
Well, they sort of did a 9/11.
And instead of understanding that that's the kind of behavior we've inflicted all over the world, we decided to become more narcissistic, more barbaric, more militaristic. I mean, that was a taste of what we have done to people everywhere. And I thought there was an impossibility that we would grasp that. That this possibly, no matter whether it was concocted, however it happened, concocted or not, and certainly with the cooperation of insiders here.
What do you mean by that? I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, they didn't scramble the jets they had a lot of opportunities to, prevent it or to actually investigate it as a crime rather than just considered a terrorist act as if it was an excuse to expand our warfare. I don't believe the government's report. I don't believe the government's everyone. I don't believe the government's whatever they're reporting. I can't believe what they're saying. But whatever the reasons that happened was, you could argue, and I was arguing, I wrote an essay on it on my webpage, that this is an opportunity for us to understand that this could be blowback for what we've done to other people. And if we could understand that we would know that if we continue treating other people this way, like we have been for a long time, especially since World War II, we're going to have more blowback. We're going to create what I call retail terrorists, which will then escalate our wholesale terrorism against everybody in the world. It's a vicious spiral that will kill us all. I mean, it is insane. So, of course, I'm opposed to the drone bombings anywhere. I don't like the whole technology of drone and biotechnical warfare. And we've had our first protests now at the drone base in Nevada, where a number of people have been arrested for protesting, because that's where where some of the pilots are behind these computer screens in communication with computers in the Middle East directing these drones. So we've had some concern about it. Also another demonstration near Syracuse, New York, where some drones are in near Rome, New York. It just seems like we're immune in general in this society from the pain and suffering that we're imposing on others to maintain our way of life. I don't know if I said this in the book. Perhaps did. We're moving from the era of entitlement, which was enabled by plunder, and we're moving into the era of consequences, like the chickens coming home to roost. And it's an opportunity to learn about humility, if we would take the opportunity for what it's offering us.
Let me take the opportunity of bringing in another caller who wants to talk to you. That's Greg. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about coordinated efforts. I would think that if people were to become tax refuseniks at a larger scale, we'd cut off the blood supply to people that were making some of these really poor decisions. And my question is, how would that be coordinated? How would that get started? How would that become a much larger movement so there wasn't just maybe a few people that were left hanging out there with their pants down, so to speak, how would it go and be coordinated to be something that was an effort that was a much larger in scale and then difficult to kind of stop and really make a big statement?
Well, that's a good question.
I'm getting this from a lot of emailers and everything. You know, I mean, how do we organize? How do we get more momentum?
There are about 10,000 tax refusers in the United States, I think, now. I mean, there is a national group called the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Council, which is trying to do just exactly what you as the caller have suggested. It's just very tough. It's another leap people make. I made the leap myself, and it took me 3 years to process the thought of being a tax refuser, which I felt was the correct position for me personally. And I met other people who were tax refusers.
Perhaps you didn't get prosecuted because, you know, you had been too much of a martyr and brought that on the IRS. In fact, you know, these kind of consequences for – let me just go to a quick email here, what I wanted to bring into the picture for listeners from Marissa, says, I was very moved by Mr. Wilson's action 20, 30 years ago, and I agree with his politics. However, I'm reacting against some of his recommendations for action, which seem really unrealistic. In general, I find them too dramatic and impractical. In fact, if we followed your recommendations, we'd end up homeless or dead. That is, give up everything and go to Washington to sit down without my iPod? How would I get there? I can't afford that. I can barely pay my rent here. What good does it do to anyone if I'm homeless and possibly dead? I think we need to leave aside the drama and figure out how to build movements. That's what will change things. What does he say about movement building?
Well, I believe that the movement has to be decentralized and relocalized. So although I think it would be great if 50,000 people would go to Washington, they would obviously be the ones that could go to Washington, you know, and that leaves out lots of other people who are not going to be able to afford to go to Washington. But I do think we need to think about how do we reorganize locally in our communities everywhere. So we have thousands of people thinking about local food.
On that note of local organization, we're going to have to come to a conclusion because it's the end of the hour. Brian, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you.
S. Brian Wilson, the book Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson. Thank you for listening. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.